Hello, Patreons. We just got done finishing with the one-shot, The Grim. I think we mostly had a really good time, but I think there's some pretty cool and fun subjects to talk about. I want to kick it off with one of the things we were talking about just a moment ago off camera, but the angsty relationship between Adam's character and Total Biscuits. It is both, and I want to see what you guys think about this, it's fun and cool to be contentious, but it's also like a fine line to walk because some people, especially in chat, which we're watching, get really uncomfortable, or you're not sure if the other person's having fun with that as well. I mean, how did you guys handle that and feel about it?
Well, so what chat did not get to see was immediately following the first section. So we did the intro, we played a little bit, immediately following the first section. One of the first things that the TB said was like, hey, is everybody okay with like the tone that our character interactions are taking? Right. So we checked in and he was like, hey, is this a thing? You guys feel like good about that? And we were all like, yep. Cool. I'm on board. Mm-hmm. And that opened the gate so that even if later down the line, if I'd been like, okay, man, I need you to take a fucking step back, I would have felt comfortable saying that. And had it been longer than like a one shot, maybe it would have been interesting to say like, okay, let's see if we can develop these characters' relationships. Like it's fun to start in a like Absolutely. Aggressive place. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Like it didn't bother me because we are, you know, we're playing characters and part of the fun is seeing the ways that the characters interact and they don't always have to just be like best buds all the time.
I think a lot of good character development comes through dealing with adversity, but not just obvious external adversity.
Yeah.
When it comes to group interactions and group dynamics, in particular, a lot of 40K stuff is very much driven by this. If you read any of the Eisenhorn trilogy, any of the Ravenor trilogy, anything associated with that, you have these bands, these disparate groups that were brought together under one purpose that don't really get along. They have some pretty major differences in ideology and opinion, and to assume that a band would just be completely cohesive right off the bat and agree with everything everybody else is saying would be unrealistic. I think
you put a bunch of like totalitarian authoritarians together in a group and say you have all this power. They're not going to agree with how to wield it, right?
No,
like they may all be like, yes, we can agree that the emperor is the best, but how best to serve him is a question.
I mean, that's an issue within the Inquisition itself. There's been a whole books written on that, the various different sects and ideologies of the Inquisition. I'm not just talking, you know, your Orthodox versus radical. There's even factions within that. And I can't bring that out to memory. What there was a faction that Eisenhorn was part of. That was a particular, fairly rare faction within the Inquisition. There's a ton of disagreement and different interpretations. And honestly, when I was building my character, I quite specifically built it off the back of Adam's. I watched Adam's character creation video, and I wanted to do a Ministorum kind of character, Ecclesiarch. And I was initially going to go for a full-on, rabid, zealous, wield eviscerator, destroy all of the enemies kind of right. thing. But knowing that there was already an Ecclesiarch on the team, I wanted one that would have an interesting dynamic and show, you know, there's a couple of different interpretations of the Imperial Creed. And in particular, you'd take an Aspire character. So I wanted to be kind of man of the people and have there be interesting dynamic there.
Yeah.
That's what I get the most fun out of, in my opinion.
Me too. And I was third in line there. I also watched Adams, and I was online when you were creating your character with Jeff, kind of watching through Roll 20 as I was messing with my character. And I played off of that, the third angle, which was like, if these two characters are going to have an ideological difference or come to head in some way, it would be fun to play the character who's just the hound waiting to hear the master's voice, like which one of these guys is going to be the one to decide. And that all fit together along with Reese's character as the outsider. That was like the unknown element outside the warband, who made everything, put a context on everything. We weren't just, people showing up from off world, killing random people. He was with us. Like he knows everybody that we just massacred, which adds a whole new dimension to it.
That was kind of an interesting angle, as we did not at any point in time discuss, is someone going to be a leader of this, even lore-wise in the hierarchy? You were
we're all underlings, right? Like no one can be the leader because we have one. He's just not here. Mm-hmm. He, like the emperor, has better things to do than tell us what to do. So yeah, it's interesting that the game does that kind of flat hierarchy below. There's no, I'm the second in command to the Inquisitor. It's just like, we're all serving him in our own way, mm-hmm. which opens the floor up to that kind of debate, because you can't just, in a society as sort of lawful evil as the Imperium is, you can't just point to a law and say, well, I'm in charge because of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially when you're going to do a mission where there's no inquisitorial seal being involved, that essentially, you are not an Inquisitor's acolyte at that point, not in the eyes of the planet at any rate. You
that
don't
was
have
smart
that
mission
level
design
authority
from Jeff.
Yeah, that made it a lot more interesting that we couldn't just flash the Imperial seal and have everybody do what we said. And also, because there's exterminatus and cults involved, my character couldn't just impose the status of an arbitrator either. I thought that was a really, really fun and good twist.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, it was one of those things where it was kind of funny, because a lot of the ideas I have, even for my own characters or whatever, are very impromptu. This one, I was like, yeah, they're going to be chasing a guy. And then I thought about it, and I was like, wow, that's really fucking hard to craft, actually. And then, like, as I started to kind of work through it, it is so hard, because so much of, and you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but like, so much of role playing is like, answer questions, they're not answering questions, kill them, all right, answer questions, did answer questions, kill them, you know, like, and I'm not hating on you guys or anything, because I do the same thing, but it's like, I almost feel like the system has to have a lot of things in place in order for a proper
exactly. Well, and that's why I think it's not even so much like when I level criticism at jokingly or seriously at Dark Heresy, it's not just there's a lot of rules, because I like games that have lots of rules, right? Yeah. My favorite game has tons of rules. Yeah. It's not that there's a lot of rules; it's that the rules don't address what the game is supposed to be about. Like, they give you five different ways to scroot stuff, but no real, like, the GM can't say, here's how we feed out information to the players. It's just like, no, you have to interrogate them. If they don't listen to you, you murder them with your chainsaw and you move on to the next person.
Yeah.
And the game structure is built into the mechanisms. And so it doesn't help you. And it falls to you as a GM to be like, well, should I tell them now? Or, like, in our case, what I was trying to do with the crowd scene, where I was like, I tell the crowd to bring forth their heretics, was a flag to you, Jeff, to be like, okay, we know that we accidentally killed the NPC that knew the thing. Please give us another one. We're sorry we broke this one. Yeah, please, just like, here's an in-game excuse for you to give us someone who will spill the beans. Because I knew also, that the game wasn't going to do that for you.
There's also a real tension in the assumptive factors of role-playing, which is, we're going to make characters, we're going to play them for several sessions, we're going to have these adventures, and I think that undermines Dark Heresy to some degree, where the one-shot really doesn't, where it is entirely possible in the setting of the game and who our characters are for us to do the thing we did tonight, where we show up, we make bad choices, we fuck things up, mistakes are made, someone comes in at the last second and scoops it out from under us. That's a perfectly in fiction outcome for a Dark Heresy warband. But if you're gamers who expect, like, we're the heroes and we succeed and we get what we want and we come out on top, that's fighting the sort of fictional friction there in Dark Heresy. Yeah. And I really appreciated mostly because of the pressures of a one-shot, we got to have this experience of being not disposable characters, but like very low on the totem pole in this world that's way bigger than us and shit is happening. We fuck things up. The world is all going to get blown up tomorrow. It felt very grimdark to me in that sense. Mm-hmm. It didn't feel like a normal role play session.
Cogs in a very large machine. You know, even the big bads in this universe, you know, even when you're dealing with the Space Marines or even going as far up as the Grey Knights, even people that powerful in the 40K universe still get massacred on a fairly regular basis, because that's just how insane Warhammer 40,000 is with the way that it scales power. So to suggest that a band of random inquisitorial acolytes that are generally little more than people who have been press-ganged off the Underhive to come and help or else, to assume that they're going to somehow make it through unfathomable danger, no, probably not. And even if they do, whether or not they're going to accomplish anything doesn't matter. It was a nice little quote. I had a bunch of quotes up, as you might have guessed during the show, to bring up at appropriate points. And one of them kind of really struck me as being like this world in a nutshell, this emperor, the Imperium in a nutshell. And it says, the Imperium, how mighty its aspect, how far-reaching its boundaries. As one world dies, 10 more are brought into the fold. Fear us, for we count the lives of planets, not men.
Yes, that's perfect. Yep.
Yeah, that's how insignificant everything we just fucking did was. And you've got to play that game in that context.
If this game had a system that let us, like, you know, we could make a character in five minutes.
I was going to say, if it didn't take 3 hours to make a character.
Yeah.
And we had, like, a stable. Like, each character's on an index card, and they would feel very disposable and very, like, cogs in the machine, like you said, TB. Like, that would be really cool if we had that. And we could do that. We could pre-gen a bunch of dudes, like, and totally, have a, you know.
Here's all we have to do, John, because the license for 40K role-playing games is up for grabs. Yeah, all we got to do is kickstart several tens of thousands of dollars to buy the license, and then just, you know, make a really cool game.
I'm sure Games Workshop will be that generous.
You could actually do that, because people would flood to a Kickstarter like that. Absolutely.
That would be an amazing resource management game. You get 10 characters and you have to survive 10 rounds of role play.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
they actually do one that's kind of like that for Cocorelli. Isn't Only War an Imperial Guard squad RPG where your squad's a bunch of NPCs and you kind of expend them as you would equipment or resources?
Yeah,
they have tried it. I don't know how good it is. It definitely was the one that interested me the least out of the various 40K roleplay systems.
Well, yeah. I think one of the cool things about roleplay, and it is funny because Dark Heresy always had that stereotype of, like, you're going to lose characters, just people are going to die, because there's the attrition system, which we didn't get into, about insanity.
Oh, yeah.
We saw what the fear chart can do. Like, the second you start stepping forward to something that was just horrifying. There's actually another level below that. It can get really messy. But part of what always brought me to roleplay in general is just I love the progression of a character, and, like, you have an idea of what they're going to do, and then you see that. So kind of along those lines, we had a really funny perspective because, you know, we did the character creation video, which you Patreons I'm sure saw, but Reese had this really awesome idea for this mega Judge Dredd badass Arbitas. and it didn't quite play out that way, Reese. Were you having a good time? Is that okay with you? Or what's your perspective on how that kind of played out?
Yeah, my vision for my character was very much Judge Dredd, who had some, like, predetermined knowledge where I could help maybe spring something on the party or guide them in a certain direction. Instead, Arbitrator Severus ended up being a violent bully that was also extremely incompetent. Yeah. But it made the story infinitely more enjoyable for the
So viewers. You started off the way most cops think of themselves, and you ended up the way most cops actually are.
Too real, Adam. Yeah.
Hidden political messages and agendas in this show.
Yeah.
In the show about space fascists. You do bring up a nice point, though, about role-playing in general and an obsession with systems and minutiae. To me, when role-play is the best, it is when the dice and the systems are used to drive the narrative, not the other way around. It's more fun hearing you explain away your dice roll failures and have the narrative develop that way than it is to roll the dice in the first place. I don't actually really care about the results or the systems or, well, but I have this skill that's going to let me reroll and plus one and whatever. You know, the dice just sort of exist as a mechanism to generate new narrative in my eyes anyway.
You got to roll with the punches. It's like doing improv, right? Like,
Yeah, that's exactly what it is.
You have this vision for your character, but it turns out he's an inept, like, idiot. Well, run with that because it's funny and it's fun.
Yeah, I mean, I think
Vincent Baker has a great
bias, though. Total Biscuits character, where, like, one minute he very successfully is calming a crowd, the next minute he's making an incredible attack roll, blowing up an attack servitor. That was because of the dice, and it made it funny that we talked about how that, like, gets played out. I thought
Vincent has a great article on his blog. Vincent Baker, he designed Dogs in the Vineyard and Apocalypse World and a bunch of other amazing games. And he talks about how the game system is a bit of a bulwark. Like, left to our own devices as humans, we will try to come to consensus probably, and we'll over time, like, kind of agree, like, yeah, you're right, Reese, your Kai is a cool Judge Dredd character, and we'll kind of, like, support each other. And a good game system steps in and throws you those curveballs. So it keeps us from just sort of, like, agreeing to everything. It makes us have to roll with those punches and disrupts our common consensus. But a good game does it in a productive way that's in genre and fits with the fiction and all those kind of things. But it helps us it's our improv partner. I think that's a good way to look at it.
And I feel like it doesn't make you feel powerless to it as well. Like that's an important part of the system. I too don't get bogged down super heavy in the minutia of a system, but I enjoy when it enriches the experience and enables you, good and bad. I've had characters suffer really bad stuff, but if it didn't feel like it was a random infliction, like, it just is now, and you take ownership of it, I find it really, really fun that way.
Yeah, it's an interesting point as well that these are shows that are produced for consumption as opposed to a role play session just between friends in private. And you can have a lot of disagreement amongst a group of friends privately as to how strictly you should adhere to the systems. But when you throw the audience into the mix, especially considering a lot of them are very keen on almost perfect adherence to rules and mechanics, then you have that almost working against the ability to create an entertaining narrative for the audience. It's a difficult conflict to overcome, I feel.
Yeah, I think the thing that you do is just set a precedent and stick to it, right? Like, you say, like Jeff said, if we have a rule at hand, we'll use it. Otherwise, you can make a ruling, look it up later, and return to it and be like, okay, from now on, we'll use the correct rule. But keeping things moving, but people don't, audience members don't tend to to like that. They tend to get.
Which is
a little like freaked out because it's unpredictable for them.
You'd think it would go the other way, wouldn't it? You know, but I guess
you would think so. I think it's the reason is that it's like a construct in their head. They're listening to us and they're seeing our faces, but everyone watching a role play show is creating the TV show of the game in their minds, and it's a bit of a juggling act to keep it going and make it coherent and make things work. And when inconsistencies appear, it undermines that, and it can make people say, wait, hang on, I thought I was trying to imagine you shooting the guy, and now you're saying you didn't shoot the guy, and I have to like retrofit this thing into my brain that, you know, any inconsistencies I make them nervous, I think, because they're trying to watch a show, and it makes it tough.
Mm. Some people view it as more of a contest than they do as a piece of entertainment media. It happens a lot more in video games than it would in something like this. And it's more understandable, I think, in video games. I remember Jeff's probably had this experience playing a lot of XCOM on stream and taking a shot that people said, you should not have taken that shot. That was objectively the wrong play. And yet, you know, have that shot hit and, you know, just take a Hail Mary because you felt like it, because that's the story you wanted to tell. That's the story you wanted to be a part of, even though it wasn't the optimal play.
It's exceptionally unusual in role-playing games because there's two kinds of feedback that I find I get from chat when I'm DMing or GMing a game. One is like rules feedback where they're like, this is not how that rule works, which is fine. We've trained them to give us page numbers and to like look up rules for us and stuff. And I'm like, okay, cool. Next time we'll do it correctly. And then there's the like, I would have done it differently, or why did that NPC react that way? Like, well, those soldiers would have run away. I'm like, really? The fictional construct in my mind that I just made up would have done this thing that you've made up? Like, it's interesting because I think it's an investment thing where they're like, I have, like John said, they build an idea of the way that the game is going and then think forward to be like, oh, this would be cool if this was the next thing. And if we veer left, when they veer right, they're like, oh, I have dissonance now. I'm like, well, they would have run away, but they stayed. Why is that?
Yeah, you suspend their disbelief and you disrupt the narrative. It's just like when you're watching a comic book movie or something that you love and they do something that's out of canon or even deviates from canon slightly in your opinion, you instantly notice and it disrupts your suspension of disbelief.
Yep. Yeah, but it's like the reverse of canon almost. It's like their imaginary forward thinking, things that haven't even happened yet.
What's it called? Headcanon?
Yeah, it's like a headcanon. It happened to us, Jeff, in one of our first Blades games, like maybe the second session where there was a random guard on a ship that Carolus caught unawares at knife point and intimidated him. And everyone was like, why would he be intimidated? All he has to do is cry out and his friends will come help him. I'm like, well, he's not a fucking robot. Like, there's a knife at his neck and some dude is looking in his eyes and going, I'm gonna murder you. Like,
and that
seems fair. I mean,
that idea, that whole thing of letting the dice decide some stuff is what makes role-playing games fun. It turns your never fail, always headshot Judge Dredd character into this much more complicated like interesting thing, right? Like if you just gotten what you wanted, right? If you had just been the Judge Dredd, the one-dimensional guy from the beginning, you were like, everyone obeys you, everyone gets shot when you want to shoot them, then we wouldn't have this space to be like, oh, I wonder why he's such a fuck up, or I wonder like what happened. So yeah. What can I do to like change the direction on that character?
I agree with you 100%. Like yeah. We could have gone into the backstory of how he never felt like he lived up to his father's expectations.
Right.
He was hiding his alcoholism.
Exactly. Yeah.
That could have come out of that character, but that's what makes it such an enjoyable experience, is because the random element disrupts the narrative that you have in your head.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. There's also the losing is fun mentality. You know, failure creates more interesting stories than success, in my opinion.
Yeah, and if you're playing a game that supports that, then absolutely. Yeah. A lot of games are like, you failed. Cool. You look like a jackass. It's not your turn anymore. Next.
Yep.
But there are lots of games that are like, oh, you failed. What's an interesting thing that can come from this?
Yeah.
Well, and that's why I don't think, Jeff, like you were saying, like, I'm trying to be fair, which is totally smart and good of you. But at the same time, when your badass monster comes out and just fucking fears us all, and we got to make these crazy rolls, that is Warhammer. Like, we all cheered when that happened because we were like, oh, fuck, yeah, like, yes, this is what Warhammer is all about. Like, some crazy demon comes out and our characters freak out. That's perfect. And it's unfair in the sense that we don't get to decide what our characters do. We roll and find out. But it's totally perfect for the type of game we're trying to play. And so we, like TB was saying, like, enjoying failure is important just in general, but also in a game like this, we should just exult in the idea that our characters are victims, essentially.
The place where Dark Heresy does the best is that exact thing. It's the fear tables. Yeah. It's the getting your character's arm ripped off by a monster tables. Like, it really, that's where it's the most fun. And so I think having the session, like, I was out for the whole end of the fight, but it was still fun because I was like, yeah, of course, my like highborn, like pompous guy passes out at the first sign of a mutant. Like, oh my, like, it works great. Like, it's exactly what I wanted from that character. Awesome. So, yeah.
I could see some depth in Dark Heresy on those charts too, because there's like mutations and stuff like that that you can encounter. There's cybernetic upgrades that just the charts are where it can get pretty fun, I think.
That's the best thing about that game, for sure.
A lot of the best kind of 40K stuff has been chart driven. Even like one of you mentioned that you played quite a lot of Mordheim back in the day.
Yeah.
Necromunda and Gorkamorka, in particular, when it came to their campaign structure as well as the character progression, lots of charts. Lovely, either D66 or mostly D66, because they were very against using D10 and D20 in the majority of Games Workshop products. So you had a lot of D66 tables, and they were tons of fun to roll on. And Dark Heresy does that just on a grander scale.
Yeah, I always love those the Realm of Chaos or Realms of Chaos books that just have pages and pages of random mutations that you can use in any Warhammer game.
Lovely.
I had
D66 tables in Blades in the Dark. They're still there. There's many of them. And one of my first editorial feedbacks from my editor was, you need to explain to people, like, how do you roll on these weird charts that you have in here? And I was like, oh my God, people don't know how to roll on D66 charts. Oh my God. I have to explain it.
Born in the wrong generation. You don't know what that is. Weirdly enough, I guess you don't need, I mean, with the digital age, D66 is largely obsolete. You know, it was a nice little system to make sure you didn't have to buy extra crazy sided dice. You don't really need that anymore.
Yeah, you can roll a D27 if you need to.
Whatever you want.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, as it turns out, guys, when you get a bunch of people that love the shit they do together, they'll talk for a long time. But that is
I'm going to cut out that Patreon money this month. Jeez.
That will have to wrap it up for now. But just a shout out to the patrons, of course, for supporting JP and everyone that gets to enjoy this awesome stuff, and Adam and John as well. And then thanks to you guys again. Had a blast. I hope we get to do more stuff like this. Make sure and do the extra mile to patrons and follow these people on Twitter and check out the stuff they do. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everybody.